This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast 23. Thank you very much for listening. In just a few minutes, we're going to get to a great interview with Charlie Bamforth about foam and head retention. This week's sponsor for the episode is More Beer. More Beer is one of the largest online suppliers of home brewing supplies, including kits, ingredients, and equipment. We really appreciate their support. You can show how much you appreciate them by going to beersmith.com/morebeer. So take a minute right now to go to beersmith.com/morebeer and check out their catalog and place an order. My second announcement is the promised update to Beersmith 2 is coming next week. This is part of a process that I've started to continuously update Beersmith 2. We've added several add-ons just in the last few weeks, but we're going to continue to add more features and more tools. If you haven't got your copy of Beersmith 2, or if you haven't transitioned over from Beersmith 1 to Beersmith 2, you can get your free 21-day trial at beersmith.com. And now, since I don't have any further announcements, let's jump into this week's interview. Today, my guest is Dr. Charles Bamforth, the Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor of Brewing Science, which, of course, is the coolest job title in the world. He's at the University of California, Davis. Charlie, it's great to have you back on the show.
My pleasure. You know, they call me in Berlin, they call me the Pope of Foam.
The Pope of Foam.
Isn't that a terribly sad thing to be known as?
But it's good to be the Pope of something, I guess, right? The Pope of Foam. I did not know that. Is that your Facebook ID? Pope of Foam? Twitter?
No, it's not my Facebook ID. No. Put my name into Facebook.
Better go out and grab that before the show comes out. Somebody will take it away from you. Anyways, Charlie, how did you get interested in studying bubbles and foam?
Well, it's a long time ago now, and I was running a research team at a place called the Brewing Research Foundation in England. And one of the guys, or two of the guys who joined my team were working on foam. And so I started getting involved in supervising what they were doing. And pretty soon I got deeply involved in it myself. And so I guess it's from 1979, I guess, did my first work on beer foam. And I'm still doing bits and pieces on it now.
That's fantastic. Can you share a little bit about the history behind carbonation? You know, I believe many early beers were not carbonated, right?
Well, they wouldn't have been. You know, to actually have carbonation, you've got to have a closed vessel, really. And although carbon dioxide will build up in a beer, even in an open fermenter, the amounts involved are not very, very large. Of course, as part of fermentation, sugar is converted into alcohol and carbon dioxide. So there'll always be some degree of carbonation. But unless you seal those vessels and allow the carbon dioxide to accumulate, particularly under pressure, the CO2 concentration will be relatively low. So way back in the day, you know, 8,000 years ago, they probably weren't worried about the foam, and there certainly wouldn't have been a heap of carbon dioxide in there. But there will always be some degree of carbonation.
So do you have a rough idea when we actually started serving beer carbonated? I just wonder.
Well, you know, if you look back, it will be advanced with speed from the time that beer really was being bottled and, of course, certainly canned as well. So, you know, it at least dates back into the last century. But I'm not really a historian. It's certainly my focus has always been on bubbles in the 20th and 21st centuries, rather than exactly when it really kicked off.
Well, obviously some styles, you know, like a lot of American beers are highly carbonated, and other ones have little or no carbonation. Why do we see such a variance across all the different beer styles?
Well, you know, what people often ask me, what is my favorite beer? And of course, I never answer the question, but one of my favorite styles is the traditional beer of my homeland, which is cask ale, and that is relatively lightly carbonated. There is some carbonation and some priming goes on in the barrel to actually get, say, 1.1, 1.2 volumes of CO2. Other beers, and of course we think of the, for example, the lighter flavored North American lagers, the carbonation is very important to them because it speaks to the sparkle and the tingle and the mouthfeel of those products. And so for those lighter products, particularly a high degree of carbonation is quite significant. Another thing that will have influenced carbonation historically will have been lagering for Germanic beers, you know, mm-hmm. and the whole lagering process for long periods of time in caves at low temperatures. One of the things that will have happened there was there would have developed a higher degree of carbonation. So there is a historical dimension to this. But you know, it really is on a beer by beer basis. Things like Hefeweizen, of course, are very highly carbonated.
Yeah.
Because they've still got a whole bunch of yeast knocking around there, you know, and historically that will have allowed them to have developed significant amounts of carbonation in the final package.
Well, carbonation is measured in volumes, right?
Yeah.
Now, what can you explain what a volume is and basically what that means for a home brewer?
One volume of CO2 basically would be 1 milliliter of carbon dioxide in every milliliter of beer. And that's roughly equivalent to 2 grams of carbon dioxide per liter. So if something's one volume of CO2, it's going to be 2 grams per liter. So, you know, an English traditional cask ale will be somewhere in the vicinity of 2 to 2.5 grams per liter, whereas a small pack North American lager is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of 5 grams or more per liter. A Hefeweizen is going to be more than 6 grams per liter. And the carbonation is measured basically, but you know, the traditional way is to shake it out, is to have your bottle and you pierce a hole in the cap and then you shake it vigorously. And by monitoring the change in pressure, if you like, using a manometer-based system, you'll measure the amount of gas which is in that beer. Now, there are other ways of measuring carbon dioxide. I often say to the students, the easiest way of measuring carbon dioxide is using a carbon dioxide analyzer. Just don't expect me to explain.
And everybody has those at home.
Subtle physics and electronics of it. But that's basically how it's done.
But if I did the math right, I tried to do these conversions in my head, but one volume is roughly, you know, what an open vessel might be.
At the end of fermentation, you're going to be in that vicinity.
In that range.
Here is a super saturated solution. What that means of CO2, what that means is in a bottle of beer, or a can of beer, for example, there's much more carbon dioxide than would dissolve in it sort of naturally. If you equilibrated, an alcohol solution with carbon dioxide without applying any increased pressure, the amount of carbon dioxide is much lower than you would get in a beer. But when you open a small pack beer, it doesn't spontaneously foam. You know, I hate it, but I go into restaurants and you see them gently taking the top off the bottle and then pouring it ever so slowly down the side of the glass. And that, you know, they're trying to avoid bubbles forming. So you can make a pretty good fist at not bringing that CO2 out of solution as bubbles. Whereas, of course, what you want to do is entirely to produce foam. You know, you want to produce lots of foam because actually most people like it.
Mm-hmm. So again, I'm just going back to your examples. 2 is roughly a cask ale or an English ale, right? Two volumes. Because most homebrewers work in volumes.
A cask ale will
right?
be somewhere in the low ones. So a low cask ones, ale okay. might be about 1.1, 1.2 volumes.
Right.
And then, the way they get that is traditionally is at the end of fermentation, A small amount of sugar is added to the finished beer, along with those dry hops and those isinglass finings. And you ensure, of course, that you've got a viable population of yeast left behind in the barrel. And what that yeast does is to take that sugar and boost the level of carbonation. It's called natural conditioning, of course. And there are some pretty notable beers in the world that are bottle conditioned in that way. Mm-hmm. They are naturally conditioned in the bottle. And of course, one of the best examples is Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, where the carbonation is introduced by that, if you like, inverted commas, natural process. And Ken Grossman does it that way because that's the way he's always done it. You know, he couldn't afford a carbonator back in the day. I think he can afford one now, but he still has his natural conditioning process.
So, I mean, that sort of leads into the next question, which is what are the different ways you can actually go about carbonating beer?
That's one way, which is the natural conditioning. Another way of carbonating beer, obviously, is basically to bubble in carbon dioxide in a closed vessel. So if you have a sealed tank, and if you bubble in CO2, then according to Henry's law, carbon dioxide will go into solution depending on the pressure of the carbon dioxide Well, that's basically the main determinant. Actually, there are some pretty nifty membranes that are available now, certainly on a commercial scale. They're so-called hydrophobic membranes. And what they do is you flow the beer through these very thin stream of beer. And on one side of the membrane is the beer. On the other side is the carbon dioxide. And depending on the partial pressure, if you like, or the amount of carbon dioxide, and depending on the temperature, of course, because gases are more soluble at lower temperatures, and depending on the length of the membrane, you can regulate how much carbon dioxide you pass into the beer. And at the same time, any oxygen in the beer will pass in the other direction and go out through the membrane.
That's kind of cool.
And if you wanted to put any nitrogen into the beer, you could have nitrogen mixed in with the carbon dioxide, and that would go into the beer. So it's a pretty clever way of doing it. And the advantage is that you don't run the risk of foaming up. You know, you bubble carbon dioxide into beer in a tank, then if you're not very careful, you'll get some foam produced on the top of the beer. And when that collapses, it'll form insoluble particles, and that can jeopardize your beer quality.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Beer is full of fascinating stuff, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think we're gonna dive into the science of it in just a minute. But
all right.
What effect does carbonation have on the perceived flavor of different kinds of beer? I know you mentioned lighter beers are generally highly carbonated, but how does it affect your flavor perception?
Obviously, the big effect is the tingle, the sparkle. What carbon dioxide does is it interacts with what is called your trigeminal sense. So the thing in your sensory system that detects pain, things like, you know, chili peppers and so on, that's called the trigeminal sense. And carbon dioxide reacts with that. So really, it's a pain response. You know, I like to tell students, you know, you get a beer, as long as you're 21, of course, and you dangle your tongue in it and leave it there, you know, it'll start to hurt, you know, and you love it. You love the pain and the agony. So the tingle and the sparkle, and of course, isn't it wonderful when it grabs you on the back of the throat, you know, and anyway, very refreshing. So really that is the main impact of the CO2 directly. But of course, the CO2 also will drive other flavor substances into the headspace. So the amount, you know, you're going to have a passage of flavor active molecules out driven by the CO2. And this is one of the reasons why, of course, you should swallow the beer. None of this ridiculous spitting that they do with other types of beverage, which of course are usually not carbonated. But with beer, you need to swallow it. And of course, CO2 is released, and that is driven up the back of your throat and up into the nose. And most of the flavor of beer, you detect using your nose anyway, the aroma. So the carbonation in that respect is very, very important. Obviously, for lower carbonation beers like the cask ales, then they have much less of that tingle. They are much, it's a more, a smoother drink. It kind of glides down very, very lovely as well. I could drink one right now, but I'm sitting in California and there isn't one to hand.
It's too bad. You'll have to get one after the show.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the actual bubbles for a minute. How is the head formed on a beer, sort of at the micro level?
Yeah, as I said, the beer doesn't spontaneously foam, even though it's got all that carbon dioxide in it. Even a cask ale has got quite a lot of carbon dioxide in it. But as I say, it doesn't spontaneously foam. So what you have to do is to generate, put some work in, so put some energy in there to produce the bubbles, and that is called nucleation. And there's various ways of doing it. Obviously, you can agitate the beer with a hand pump or something like that. Or, of course, you can have what is called nucleation sites. So if you put a scratch on the bottom of a glass, where that scratch is, bubbles will start to form. And indeed, you can buy glasses that they're not so much scratches as engineered sites on the bottom of the glass that will allow bubbles to be produced. And those bubbles will rise through the beer. It's called beading. And that gives you this constant stream of bubbles rising from the bottom, which of itself is kind of appealing and very nice to look at. The good thing is it also supplements the foam. It continually is regenerating foam, so that helps to make sure you have a stable head. So really, you have to do work to generate a foam. That's what the widget is in the bottom of these low carbonation canned products. Guinness, of course, pioneered it, but there are others as well. And what the widget does, that's a nucleation device. Basically, it is an exercise in producing bubbles. There are other things that are important for bubble formation. One of the most important ones is the temperature.
Can you explain that for just a minute? Because I think it's kind of interesting. A lot of people think the little device in the bottom of a Guinness can is like a carbonation device of some kind.
No, it's not. The carbonation, right? the carbon dioxide and nitrogen gas are in the beer. But of course, when you fill the can, it's done under pressure, and the whole contents are under pressure. When you release that pressure, when you open the can, and you can hear a shh noise, basically that is the sign that nucleation is starting to happen, and it's triggered in that little hole down in the bottom of the device. But you don't even need that little hole, really. Even if you've just got a rough old piece of paper in there, the surface allows bubbles to form. Now, the science of nucleation is extremely, extremely complicated. Amazingly complicated, but really, if you've got a rough surface, that is all you need for bubble formation. So that little widget is not a little canister of gas. It is actually a device for generating the bubbles. But one of the things, and I was going on to say this, one of the issues to do with bubble formation is temperature. Gases are less soluble as you increase the temperature. So if you have an ordinary, a regular beer with no widget in sight, and you pour it out and it's cold, and you pour it out and if it's warm, you'll produce a lot more foam if the beer is warm. Now, if the beer is warm and you've got a widget in the can, step back. It's a bomb,
Like Diet Coke and Mentos, huh?
It's just a mess. You know, your pants will get extremely wet, and that's from the beer as well as the nerves. That's why those beers have got to be kept real cold before you open them, to actually dampen down the tendency of the gas to come out of solution.
Now, what's the actual science behind head retention? I mean, let's say, this nucleation takes place, you get this nice head foamy head on top of the beer. How does it, how do you get it to stay there, if you will?
Well, that's where surface active materials come in. If there are other types of drink, think colas and sodas and drinks like champagne, you produce bubbles, but they collapse instantly. And the reason is that when you produce all these bubbles, you've got a huge increase in surface area. And that is directly opposed to surface tension. Surface tension is the force that what makes water want to occupy the smallest area possible. And when you produce a foam, you've got a huge increase in surface area. So what there is in beer are surface acting materials, and these go into the wall and they act like a framework or a skeleton, and they hold it together and they counter this surface tension. And the two major materials are proteins and the bitter acids. So the proteins come from the grain. Actually, the ones from wheat are better molecule for molecule than the ones from barley, but they come from the grain. And anything, if you have a beer that has got less grain in it, with less protein in it, say more sugar or something like that, then inherently you're going to have a less foaming material in there. The second component are the bitter acids. The things that make the beer bitter are also very surface active. They're very, what we call, hydrophobic, water hating, like the proteins. And these things get into the bubble wall, and the proteins, these bitter acids, they stick together and form a framework that holds the foam together. And this takes a little bit of time. So, if you can test it out for yourself. If you just pour a beer with a nice foam on it and look at it, it's kind of wet and sloppy foam. But then if you admire it and spend some time looking at it, the foam changes to being much more solid, and then it will lace the side of the glass and give you those beautiful cathedral windows of foam lacing the side of the glass. Now, of course, those are foam positive materials. There are foam negative materials as well. And in my experience, most of the problems you get with foam are nothing to do with the shortage of foam positives, but everything to do with foam negatives. And the most important of these are detergents and fats and lipids, anything that's introduced from the food or from the washing up process. You know, never wash beer glasses with greasy plates. Always wash beer glasses with a good detergent, hot water detergent, but then thoroughly rinse off the detergent with clean water and allow those glasses to drain dry. And then you'll get a much better, more stable foam. And I always say, you know, you got a mustache, and I see from this looking at you, you don't. So that's good. But if you got a mustache, you got all that burger grease dripping into the foam, then it's an uphill battle to get a stable foam.
So as an average home brewer, though, what are some of the ways you could enhance head retention? I mean, what are some of the ingredients you might use in a beer to help enhance
it? Yeah, well, obviously, all malt is good. There is a very strong school of thought that some of the darker malts have got enhanced foaming potential. These colored materials called melanoidins that are in the darker malts, say the chocolate or certainly in the crystal malt, those sorts of things, there's a strong school of thought that they will improve the foam stability. Of course, it depends on the color of the beer you want to get. As I say, if you've got some wheat malt in there, that's usually a pretty good thing to have. Wheat malt gives a better foam. It is also argued that if you mash in infusion mash at a higher temperature, you get a better foam than if you've got a low temperature start to your mash. And some people say that if you've got a low pH in mashing, around 5.1, that gives you better, more stable foams as well. Obviously, the more bitterness you have there, then more stable the foam is going to be. Some people say, you want some of these beta-glucans in there and these polysaccharides. You know, the evidence for that is really not very strong, and it's all to do with how you measure the foam. But on a commercial scale, some people use foam stabilizers. There are things like propylene glycol alginate, PGA, which will stabilize the foam. And again, it's a personal decision about whether you want to use added stabilizers. I don't know of brewers in this country who are using that. There's this popular myth that the big guys put all these additives in, and nothing can be further from the truth. They don't. But in Europe, and certainly my old employer in the UK used to use PGA. We didn't think anything about that.
So that's one way. Are there any other tricks that a commercial brewer might use, or is it really done mostly naturally?
No, it is done by you know, best practice and selection of the grist materials. But you know, it's very difficult. You know, if you're making beer of a certain type and you establish its specification for a certain, say, a pale color or and light flavor and so on, obviously your chances are you're going to be using something which is going to dilute out the amount of foaming protein. And if you've got low bitterness, then that's not helpful for foam stability. The reality is that, you know, in a clean glass and poured properly, even the gentlest flavored beer, you can get a pretty stable foam. But obviously, it's not going to be as robust as one that is from a beer that's, you know, 100% malt, nice and dark, and with 40 BU. You know, that's that, all things being equal, as long as there's enough of everything positive in there, is going to give you a good foam. By the way, the other foam inhibitor is alcohol. Basically, the more alcohol you have in the beer, the less stable the foam. But as I'm fond of saying to people, if you've got 10% alcohol in your beer, you really don't give a rat about the foam. You're probably not even looking at it. And as for the end of history at 55% alcohol, I don't even want to think what that looks like.
So I noticed some highly carbonated beers are served in tall glasses. I mean, if you go to Germany and you get the Hefeweizen, for example, yeah, it's going to be in a tall glass. How does a glass shape affect carbonation?
Well, the nucleation systems I described earlier are important. Really, I think the glass shape is to an extent overplayed. One could argue that if you've got a glass which will minimize liquid drainage from the foam, or the rate of liquid drainage from the foam. So if you've got a glass, say, that sort of bulbs out at the top, and so the liquid doesn't drain quite so readily down the sides, it would do in a nice sort of tapered glass, that, you know, will make a contribution. But the reality is this, you know, if you pour a beer with a good foam on it, and that of itself is very interesting. You know, if as an Englishman, you know, I know that if I go into a pub in England, in London, chances are there's not going to be any bubbles, you know. But if I go to a pub in my native northern England, woe betide if there's no foam on it, you know. And questions get asked in Parliament. And, of course, being money-pinching northerner, of course, I insist on having a pint of liquid and, you know, a couple of centimeters of foam. So that's why you have the oversized glasses with a line on there. So it's the line indicates where your pint is, and then you want a nice stable foam on top of that. So the glass is important from that dimension. But the important thing, really, more than the actual shape of the glass, is the amount of foam you produce and the time you allow for that foam to stabilize. So if I pour a beer out with a lot of foam and I just start drinking it straight away with my greasy lips, you're not going to have a very good foam. And if you don't produce much foam, by the time it started to stabilize, it's kind of dribbled away, irrespective of the glass. But if you've got a nice, deep foam, and you give it a minute or two, then those protein bitter acid interactions are going to take place, and that is going to give you a nice interaction and a stable foam, irrespective of the glass. By the way, I should have mentioned earlier on that one trick that used to be applied by at least one company in the UK is they used to put a little bit of zinc into the finished beer. I'm not sure what the legality of all that is, but zinc's kind of good for the body. And if I was ever going to play around with something, I might play around with a little bit of zinc at, say, 2 milligrams per liter, because that certainly does help the foam.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned several times pouring the beer. Have you got any tips on pouring a good head?
Yeah,
pouring
with vigor. Don't be, you know, as long, well, it depends on what it is. You know, if I go to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam and they give me half a glass of foam, you know, I'm pretty ticked off. You know, I want beer. I don't want just foam, you know. But if you're in control, say you've got the bottle, you know how much beer you've got. You're not going to get shortchanged. So my tip is, you know, just pour it in with vigor. Essentially, get the whole glass converted into foam. because as it subsides, I say, it's going to those, the more foam, the greater is the opportunity for those interactions to take place to stabilize it. And then keep topping it up, keep topping it up. Basically, that's what happens in Guinness. You know, if you go to Dublin, you've got to be pretty patient to get your beer. You know, it's not going to be a, you know, 30-second job. It could be 10 minutes. And what they're doing is, because there's so much foaming potential there, they're basically filling the whole glass with foam, and then they let it settle, then put in some more, and then let it settle, and then pour in some more. And so what you get is a superb, superb foam on this beautiful dark liquid. So it really is, you know, don't dribble it in. Don't go all weak-wristed and dribble it in. Pour it with vigor and direct the flow down to the center of the bottom of the glass.
Yeah, I noticed when I visited Germany, they did the same thing with a lot of the very highly carbonated beers.
Yeah,
they would pour you know, maybe half a glass, and half of it was foam, and then they'd let it settle, and they'd pour a little more in. And
you got to be patient.
Yeah, it took quite a while to pour a glass of beer. But
yeah, yeah. And I mean, if you're desperately thirsty, just get on with it. Yeah.
Now, some beers like Guinness are actually served with a nitrogen carbon dioxide mix. And I think you mentioned that once earlier in the show, but it gives kind of a really smooth head with the tiny bubbles. What's different about the nitrogen mix?
Well, Guinness pioneered the use of nitrogen at least half a century ago, and for beer on tap, and then of course it developed into beer in small pack with the widget, and what it does is you give these very, very small foam bubbles, and because nitrogen is less soluble, it can't pass between the bubbles very easily. Carbon dioxide can, but nitrogen can't. And even though there's much, much less nitrogen than there is carbon dioxide, there may only be 50 parts per million, 50 milligrams per liter of nitrogen. That's I can tell you, that's more than enough to lead to these really small bubbles. And so if you've got really small bubbles and no opportunity for gas interchange between them, you get a much more stable foam. The other thing that happens, of course, as you say, is that you do get a very smooth texture. And to my mind, that's fine. In fact, that's very desirable for a dark Irish stout, because it tends to temper that sort of burnt, harsh, roasted character. You know, it makes for a very drinkable product. If you've got a product that isn't roasted like that, you know, and with a roast character, and you know, I for my personal taste, that makes the product too smooth, and it's not offsetting anything. The other part of this is as follows, and for reasons we have no idea about, nitrogen suppresses hop aroma, and you know, it's been known for a long, long time. But if you've got a beer that's supposed to have, a dry hop character, and you have nitrogen gas in there, that dry hop character is killed off. One company in England, Charles Wells, back in the day when everybody was starting to come out with these traditional English ales in cans with a widget, they did it, and people started complaining. What had happened to the fabulous hoppy character of the Charles Wells beer? So they took out the widget, and I don't know if they still do, but they started to write the words "widget free ale" on the can.
Widget free, huh?
Yeah. At Bass, we never ever used a widget. We on the can, it may still say it for Bass in a can. It says "forehead pour quickly." So, you know, to pour with vigor in the way I described. And of course, the less CO2, less carbonation you have in the beer, the more vigorous the pour needs to be to bring that carbon dioxide out. If you've got a Hefeweizen, then you don't have to be desperately vigorous to get a lot of foam. But if you've got a low carbonation product and there's no widget in there, you've got to do a lot of work to produce the foam. Who would have thought there was so much in this business of bubbles, huh?
Yeah, pretty interesting. Now, what about shaking a can? What does that actually
mean? No. That is, you know, that's then you get gushing.
Well, I know the guys used to do that in college. They'd shake up the can of beer and then hand it to you.
Just get rid of that get rid of those people. I mean, by, you know, just separate yourself from them. They're not good people to know.
Yeah, I always tried to. Well, Charlie, thank you for being on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add? I know we only just literally scratched the surface here, but
I'd like to add bits and pieces. I've written about bubbles. Actually, let me make a plug then. How about that?
That'd be great.
I'm just coming out with a new series of books through the American Society of Brewing Chemists, and it's a series of six, and each of these is addressed to a different aspect of beer quality. And the first one is all about foam, and it's a bit like a car manual, you know. So it tells you all about what you've got, but then it leads you through how to analyze if things go wrong. And so if you liken it to a car manual and so on, then it may be of interest to your listeners. I've got the proofs on my desk right now. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be published, but it shouldn't be too long. As I say, it'll come through the American Society of Brewing Chemists, ASBC. Yeah.
And that's how long? I mean, 6 months, a year?
It'll be within the next 6 months.
So. Oh, okay, great. So sometime probably early 2012 then.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit earlier than that. Depends. It's on their schedule and depends how quickly I get the proofs back to them.
And I'll put in another plug here. Charlie has a number of other great books that he's already written that you might be interested in. So just look up Charlie Bamforth on Amazon or your favorite bookstore and you'll see he has a number of books out. Before we go, I'm going to mention a couple of your websites, Charlie, if that's okay.
Please.
Charlie has a website at foodscience.ucdavis.edu/Bamforth, and I'll put that in the show notes since that one's a little bit long, where he features a lot of his courses, which are all sellouts, you tell me, right, Charlie?
They are, yeah.
They're pretty amazing. And also, his Facebook page is UC Davis Brewing. So I encourage you to look all those up. Charlie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Brad, thanks very much for inviting me.
It's been great to have you. Again, that was Dr. Charles Bamforth, the Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor of Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Well, thank you to Charlie Bamforth for doing that great interview. Thank you all for listening as well. We really appreciate you listening. Thanks to More Beer for sponsoring the show. Again, that's beersmith.com/morebeer when you place your next order. And finally, if you have any feedback for the show, you can leave it at beersmith.com/forum under the section for this podcast. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.